Alan Chartok. On Sunday, March 10th, I sat down with Massachusetts Governor Deval and First Lady Diane Patrick for an intimate conversation at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield. I had no idea that this was about to be one of, if not the best, interviews of my life. And it all started when I asked Diane Patrick about how she and Deval met.
I was practicing law. Deval had just come to Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles. Deval had just come to Los Angeles, having just graduated from law school, and met a friend of mine that I had gone to law school with at a dinner party. It was a dinner party designed for Deval to be introduced to people in LA. And she and I practiced together at a big firm in Los Angeles, and she came and said, you know, I met a guy that I think you just need to know. And I said, well, Debbie, that's great. You know, I'm married. And she said, I know, but, you know, I think I like your husband less than you do. And I really think you ought to meet that. I just imagine that he's perfect for you. And I continued to refuse. And she said, you know, he's only here for a year because he was clerking on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And, you know, it's been 2 months already. You only have 10 months to go. You got to meet him. Anyway, I finally said yes, if I could meet him in a crowd. And they arranged, she and some other law school friends of mine arranged to have a party, a Halloween party, and invited me. I knew the purpose of this party was to meet Deval. And they invited Deval, but they didn't tell Deval that the purpose of the party was to meet me. So he was clueless. And he was not only clueless about the fact that he was to meet me, but he was clueless about the fact that no one was coming in costume, because he came in a costume.
I was told to come in costume.
And then it turns out he was clueless that I was married. And, you know, despite his cluelessness, he did ask me out to lunch a few times, and we went out to lunch a few times. And then after a few of those occasions, he asked if we could see each other on a Saturday. And it happened to be the Saturday I was going to leave my husband for the last and final time. And I said, no, Saturday wouldn't work. I was moving. And he said, oh, you know, well, that's fine. I'll come help you move. And I said, no, I don't think that would be a good idea. He said, no, that would be a great way to get to know each other better. You know, and I'm thinking, this guy really is clueless. He doesn't. How is he going to help me move out of my marital home? And finally, I said, you know, he said, no, give me the address. I'll be there. And I said, you know, I don't think my husband would appreciate that. And he said, you're what? And I said, you don't know. Honestly, all this time, I thought he knew. He never mentioned it. I never mentioned it, but I thought he knew. And I said, you don't know I'm married? And he said, I had no idea. And that was that. And the movers came on Saturday, and I deposited me in the apartment I had rented, and I called him, and I said, I'm free. And,
I think everybody in the audience is probably wants me to ask the appropriate follow-up question, which is, what did Deval come dressed as at
oh,
the
God.
I'll let you answer
so,
that.
So, in fact, they had told me it was a costume party.
Sure.
And that I had to come in costume. And I had said I would not come in costume. And they prevailed and said, you know, don't be an uptight Easterner. So I put on a caftan I brought back from Nigeria, where I lived for a time. And I had a spear, and I painted my face. And no shoes, and I strode into the party, the only one there in costume. Diane wore a black silk pantsuit, as I recall. So, anyway.
And he figured it out.
We did figure it out. It's interesting that I was the only one, I guess, armed. So, in that sense, it was a little awkward not to accept a follow-up invitation to go out to lunch.
Do you remember, you know, seeing Diane?
Do I remember seeing her?
Yeah, in other words, you went to the party. This is your first vision of Diane Patrick, right?
Yes. Oh, I vividly remember seeing her. And actually, even I take some umbrage at the use of the term clueless, but even I had figured out that they were trying to get us together because they had a pumpkin carving contest. These are grown-ups, by the way. They had a pumpkin carving contest, and Diane and I were paired. And as I've told the story, we could have stabbed the pumpkin and won because the prize was a single bottle of champagne, as they put it, to be drunk at some private time. So, I caught on.
Amazing. So that second date?
So, you know, Deval, I left, you know, there came a time for me to leave the party. I took the bottle of champagne, I went over to say goodbye to Deval, and I said, you know, maybe one day I'll call you and we'll have this bottle. Deval denies saying this, but he said, I have better at home. And that's when I thought, this guy's got some class. And then he did call, but it took him about 6 weeks to get up the nerve to call me to ask me to lunch.
Was that right, Deval? You were getting up the nerve, or were you just playing it cool?
No, I'm kind of a mess romantically. I had dated one woman from high school through college, and then she and I got engaged, and then I went and lived in Africa for a year, and when I came back, she was engaged to somebody else. So all the years when you kind of get practice at dating, I've been with one person. So I thought, well, I'm done with law school now, and I had a couple of significant others during law school, and I'm moving out to California. I thought, okay, I'm going to start all over. It's all wild and crazy out there. I didn't think as wild as getting involved with someone who was married, but so I didn't have a lot of practice. We sorted it out. Diane was the one actually who proposed to me, if I may say.
How did that work? Tell us about it.
Don't you think that's right?
Well, did
she get down on one knee?
No. This is an extraordinary woman, as you know, and I was getting to know that about her, and just how incredibly interesting and engaging she was, and how complicated her life was. I mean, she hasn't mentioned, but the man she was married to was abusive in a whole host of ways, and she was healing from that, and I think it was a friendship first, and a pretty deep and important one. And I also was going to San Francisco at the end of that year to join a law firm. And a woman I had been dating back in law school was moving there as well. And we were going to see how that worked out. I heard that snicker. And I was clear with Diane about that. But then Diane started to pepper me with questions, you know, where's this relationship going? And I would say, well, you're married. I mean, how can you make these formally married? Not emotionally married anymore, but still legally and properly married. And Diane was frankly worried about taking the steps to become divorced because she was afraid. She was afraid of him. So eventually that got sorted out, or began to get sorted out. And as it was beginning to get sorted out, basically Diane said, what's up with this?
Diane, what's you were physically plan? Afraid of him.
Yes, I was.
And did anything come to pass as a result of that fear? I mean, did it get realized?
Well, this was a marriage that was a 7-year marriage, and 5 years of it was abusive. And it was an abuse that began emotionally and psychologically and then ultimately physically. And I left, as I said before, twice, but I came back to promises of, it's such a classic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, I know, I'll never do that again. And I kept wanting to believe. But the second time I came back to those promises, I was immediately met with, and if you ever leave me again, I'll kill you. And he showed me how he was going to do that holding a gun to my head.
No.
I didn't know he had a gun. And that's when I became very afraid. The first time he held a gun to my head, I was practicing law. I had come home late one night, and I had a hearing the next day, and I sat at the kitchen table to prepare for the hearing, and he came in having been drinking and wanted to know where his dinner was. It was 10 o'clock at night, and I said, you know, you should have gotten your own dinner. And he got very angry and came back, and he held a gun to my head and said, you're going to make me dinner. And so I did, and then when he went to sleep, I took the gun, I wrapped it in a towel, and I left and took it to a friend. And I said, I don't know what to do with this, but just dispose of it. And of course, the next morning, he was very angry that I'd done that. And lo and behold, he got another one. And that's when he was really threatening. And he said, if you ever move this gun, I was told and shown to be afraid. And indeed, when I left that day, that I called Deval and said I was free, he then stalked me. He didn't know where I was moving, and I never did tell him, but he certainly knew where I worked. And these were the days before 9/11, so in any office, anybody could come up to any floor without security guards. And the firm I worked at had about 14 floors in a tower in downtown Los Angeles. Every receptionist had a picture of him and was told to call security immediately if he came, and he did many times. And There were nights I would pull out of the garage and I could see his car down the block and he would follow me, so I'd pull right back into the garage until I knew the coast was clear. He, I was going to say unfortunately, but for me it's a terrible thing to say, but it wasn't unfortunate, but he died. Actually, while I was getting the divorce, he was diagnosed with leukemia and died pretty quickly after that. But the day he died was the first day I didn't look in my rearview mirror and wonder whether he was behind me.
Deval, you know, we men are always looking out for our ladies and worrying about them and thinking that anybody messes with my Roselle or your Diane, you know, we want to get them. Can you remember your thoughts during that time?
First of all, it was very hard to get Diane to talk about this, and I have come to learn through her and others it's a pattern of abuse that people feel responsible for it and embarrassed by it. So trying to work through that fear and shame, is that
absolutely
term? Was, I think, part of how we got to be so close. You know, Diane grew up in a very traditional West Indian, more than West Indian, kind of Eisenhower 50s.
And Grandpa was a major political figure.
That's right. That's right. Diane's grandfather was the first black majority whip of the New York Senate. New York Assembly. Brooklyn out of Bed-Stuy. And, you know, they're very middle class American in the sense of being very concerned about appearances. You marry for life. You keep your private issues private. And I think working through all that, I mean, her parents didn't know. I mean, here's the thing. Of course they knew.
They didn't
know. Now we're parents. Now we're parents.
We know.
You may not know all the details, but you know. But they never knew the details. They didn't.
And they didn't ask.
And they didn't inquire because one didn't. So I think just the experience of having the kind of conversation, I mean, it's extraordinary actually that we are having this conversation publicly. But even having this kind of conversation privately was a huge step at the time it was happening for us.
Were there things like orders of protection? I mean,
no, because it was so private. Even the only two people who knew what was going on was my sister, who lived in Atlanta at the time, and this friend of mine.
And the woman who introduced us.
The woman who introduced us. And until I left and he began to stalk me and I had to get my office. It was embarrassing to tell a law firm of, you know, 1,000 partners, I mean, lawyers and other staff that, you know, I was afraid of this man.
How were they?
Surprisingly.
They were great.
Wonderful.
They were great. They adored her.
Surprisingly wonderful and supportive. But I did say to Deval on more than one occasion, look, you know what, I'm afraid. And if you're afraid, I don't blame you for being afraid. And we don't have to do this. And Deval said, I'm not afraid and neither should you be. And I don't know what that meant if we were ever confronted, but I never got a protective order. And indeed, the reason it took me so long to get divorced or to file for divorce is because I knew the mere filing of those divorce papers, if he were served, that would be the trigger that, I mean, I lived in real fear of my life. And Deval kept saying, I don't know how you think this relationship's going to go somewhere if you're too afraid to file for divorce. And he sort of understood but didn't understand. How do we have a relationship and you're still married? And the odd turn of events happened that I called my then still husband's office. He worked at the LA Times. And
what did he do at the LA Times?
He was in advertising sales. And I had to talk to him about something because I left the house. I closed all of our credit cards. I told all of our credit card companies that I would assume all the debt because I didn't even want to have to deal with that. And I had to call him about something. We owned a house. He stayed in it. And I called him, and his secretary said, well, you know, gee whiz, don't you know he's in the hospital? And I said, no. He said, well, how do you not know he's in the hospital? He's been in the hospital a couple of days. He had never told anyone in his office that I had left him. So he was living this lie. And I said, you know, what's he in the hospital for? And she said, well, he went to have some hemorrhoids taken care of. And I thought,
served
good.
Right.
He can't.
Deval said, serve them right. And I said, it's appropriate.
Right. I thought, good, he can't get up and hurt me. And I had the divorce papers in my pocket. I had been carrying them around for months. And I thought, he can't hurt me. I'm going to go to the hospital and serve him. And I did. When I got to the hospital, I asked, you know, where was Bill Whiting's room, and they said, who are you? I said, I'm Diane Whiting, and said, you know, we've been trying to find you. The doctor's been trying to find you. Please come into this room. We'll call the doctor. And I was escorted into a small room, and I didn't know what's going on. And I said at the time, I said, you know, no, I'm not, I am his wife, but I'm not really his wife. And the doctor came in and said, you know, he was in for these hemorrhoids, you know, whatever the process is. But during that process, he spiked like 106 fever. They did test, found out he had leukemia. So here I was trying to serve him with divorce papers, and the doctor tells me he has leukemia and he probably has 6 months to live. And my immediate reaction was to leave the room and go to a public phone booth. There were no cell phones at the time, and call DeVal. And I said, I don't know what to do. I just tried to serve Bill with these divorce papers, and I'm told he's going to die. And DeVal said, I'll meet you at my apartment in half an hour. And DeVal was just a strength all the way through all of this. But he then went into remission, and that's when I was really afraid, because then I thought, this guy has no reason other than, you know, his whole mission in life now is going to kill me. And then he was in remission and out of the hospital for about 3 or 4 months. And then he ultimately went back in the hospital and died. But that day that he died was a day of liberation for me.
Do you remember any of this, DeVal, in terms of, Diane said you were a tower of strength during that time. You remember the phone calls and what that was like?
I do. I mean, I didn't know what to say or do exactly, but I knew I loved Diane, and I wanted her to know that, and I wanted to be a source of comfort. I didn't know what the answers were, but, you know, it was, I think, meaningful to her and to me that we were willing to try to figure out those answers together. And when you know Diane, or anyone of this depth of compassion, how complicated that moment was when she realized she could safely serve these papers, but couldn't bring herself to do it knowing that he had just been given a death sentence. I mean, the notion that she would have that kind of compassion for someone who was as hurtful to her as he had been says a whole lot about her. So when he got better and out of the hospital is when either you served him or had the marshal serve him, I can't remember.
No, I served him.
You remember that?
And then we were leaving, well, so this is, do you really want to hear all that?
Absolutely.
So at the, it was coming on the end of my clerkship year, so it's coming around late spring. And I was studying for the bar one weekend in an empty office next to the office that Diane worked in. And she came in and closed the door and said, one of my colleagues just came in and asked me if I would help them open their new office in New York. And Diane, of course, grew up in New York City, had always talked about going back to New York City. And I said, well, that sounds fantastic. What are you going to do? And she said, I told them no. And I said, what are you talking about? This is what you've talked about. You want to be closer to your family. You want to be back where the action is. It's obviously a recognition of your value to the firm that they are asking you to come and be one of the founding members of the New York office, which now has 400 or 500 people in it or something. And one lame excuse after another. And I finally said, well, come on, what is it? And she said, well, you're going to San Francisco. That's far enough away from Los Angeles. I don't want to go to New York. And I said, well, if you want to go to New York, I'll go to New York. And that then started a kind of a what as conversation. I'll go to New York as what? As your as your girlfriend, boyfriend, as your spouse, as you. And that's where, as I say, Diane basically said, in not so many words, let's get married. And I mean, it all happened very fast over the course of a few days of talking about this. But then once, am I remembering this part right? When anybody else have this experience where you have more than you have more than one version of the story? So it was, I think, just as we were leaving LA and going to New York,
that's right,
that Diane served the papers.
Do you remember serving the papers that moment? What was that like?
I don't know where I got the strength. I know I went to the house we owned jointly and gave them to him. There weren't too many words spoken. I mean, he knew by that time, because when he was hospitalized with the leukemia, he begged me to come back home and take care of him.
And basically the deal she proposed was, I'll take all the debt and you keep all the stuff. So how could he say no to that? Because she just wanted out. So she served, we left. And I think that straddling these worlds, or any, meant understanding exactly who you were and being that all the time, no matter what setting you were in. And I think that lesson was important in the relationship Diane and I were beginning and have had for 30 years and in a whole host of other settings as well.
But you're a man of tremendous strength. Where does the strength come from?
Well, she said clueless a second ago.
You were a strong, clueless man.
You know, Alan, I had this experience after I graduated from college. I had a Rockefeller Traveling Fellowship, which was a fellowship given by Governor Rockefeller's family in memory of their son, Michael, who had been lost in New Guinea. And the condition of the fellowship was that you spend a year in a non-Western culture. And they gave you enough money basically to get to that place and get home. Not enough to actually survive while you, or I shouldn't say survive, but you couldn't, you know, hole up in the local intercontinental hotel. You had to be of it. And I'd never traveled outside the United States before, and after a lot of backing and forthing, I ended up promised a spot on this project in Sudan. So I graduated, I spent 6 weeks hiking in England and Scotland with my best friend from high school, and then left and flew to Cairo, teaching myself the numbers and the greetings in Arabic on the flight over. And then I hitchhiked from Cairo to Khartoum. And that took about 2.5 weeks, the last week or so without a bath. So I dragged into Khartoum looking like a piece of the desert I'd just come through, to learn that the man I had been writing to for 6 or 7 or 8 months had left the week before for 2 years in Long Beach, California, and had said nothing to his office about my coming or what I was supposed to do. So, you know, there's no, email wasn't invented, you can't text, there are no cell phones. Making a long distance call required making an appointment at the phone company downtown, paying a lot of money I didn't have, and then hoping the connection lasted. So you just had to figure it out. And after a little while, the project leader on this UN project, basically to get rid of me, said, look, go out to Darfur and with a Sudanese fellow my age who just graduated from the University of Khartoum and figure out why this project is failing. And to get to Darfur, Darfur is about the distance from Khartoum as, I don't know, Cleveland is from Boston. So maybe 500 miles, something like that. It was a different place then than it is now. It was peaceful, but desolate. And the only way to get there was on track through the sand for that 500 miles. So you go to the market, you buy enough food and water for the trip, you find a market lorry, a cargo truck that's going where you're going, you buy space on top of the cargo with however many other people are traveling and all their luggage. And we set off for that 500-mile trip, which normally took about 5 days. And the second day, we went into a skid and the whole thing flipped over, and a couple people with broken bones, cargo all over the desert, and we sat there for 3 days until we were rescued, basically. Went back to Khartoum, started all over, and made it in 5 days, and I stayed out there for 6 months. Again, no contact with my family, home, no mail, nothing. If my children tried this today, I would kill them. But I figured it out. I learned to speak the language, I learned the food, I learned the rhythms of the culture, and in a way, it was a turbocharged version of going to Milton from the South Side. I figured it out. And I learned I could figure things out and to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I think probably of anything I've done, that experience in Sudan and elsewhere in Africa contributed to the strength, if that's how you describe it, that I bring to a whole bunch of things.
So when you're dealing with the majority leader in the Senate or the guys in the Assembly before they go to jail, are you...
That is unnecessary.
Okay, I apologize. Do you say, this ain't nothing compared to being in the desert for 5 days?
Yeah, pretty much. because it isn't. I mean, it just, look, you know, we are... I think much, much more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. And people are wiser than we often give them credit for. And I think particularly people in public life constantly underestimate the general public. Constantly underestimate the general public. Trust them with the facts. Tell them the truth. Tell them what you really believe, and live with the consequences. And that's what I've tried to bring to my public life, but that's also what I've tried to bring to my private life.
Well, you've just done it. You've gone a little bit in the direction that nobody else is going. You've said, let's have a more progressive taxation system. Let's give a little bit of a break on the sales tax and a little bit more on the income tax. And the traditional way of looking at it now, other governors, I'm not going to mention any names, start saying, you know, we could never do that. But you did it, and you may end up winning, but you may not. Does it matter if you win?
Well, you say we've done it. I proposed it. We're having, so far, actually a marvelously adult conversation about the price of civilization. And I don't know when or where the word tax became a four-letter word, but it's, you know, I'm not careless or light about this ask. I know it's a big ask of people, but I also know people, you know, when I always used to think George Bush, when he was advocating for his tax cuts when he was president, when he talked about how, you know, it's your money, he would always say, it's your money. And he was right. It is. But, you know, you got to finish the thought, because they're also your broken roads. They're your overcrowded schools. It's your broken neighbor and neighborhood, for that matter. And I think we got to start taking responsibility for that. And it's not that I believe It is not that I believe government can and should undertake to solve every problem in everybody's life, but I do think government has a role to play in helping people help themselves. So, what I have proposed is, how do we get there from Los Angeles and...
your strength.
And dashikis. But what I have proposed is to raise new revenue to meet the unmet needs in transportation that we have ignored for 20 years in the Commonwealth, and that we know we need to do. And by the way, not every unmet need is on that list, but some things that I think are essential we do to pay the bills we inherited and take care of what we have, and then a handful of strategic expansion projects that really unlock economic opportunity, and then to do some things, again, in a targeted way in education, that notwithstanding the fact that we are number one in the nation in student achievement and have been for each of the last 6 years, reach those kids we are leaving behind. And they tend to be poor, kids who speak English as a second language, kids with special needs, and they're concentrated where poverty is concentrated, in our so-called gateway cities. And we know what works. There are a few things we know work.
Like
early education, quality early education. There are... There are 33,000 kids on wait list for quality education in Massachusetts right now. And all the studies say that reading proficiency by the third grade is a determinant of academic performance for the rest of your life. So why in the world wouldn't we bear down on making sure that kids are ready when they enter school and that they're proficient in reading and in numeracy by the third grade? We know it works. But it's the type of long-term governing that we have lost a grip on in America, and that we've been trying to bring back in the last 6 years here in the
which brings me to the next question. Unlike many other politicians that I know, and you say, okay, you know, the number one thing they're thinking about is this White House on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and strategically, if you do this, you get this, and then you get there. But you said when you ran for governor, 2 terms, I'm out, I'm going back to the private sector,
right,
and that's it. Where does that
come? Although you badger me about taking some other job. I read your stuff, I listen to you on the radio, and you're always predicting I'm going to do something else.
I had an Aunt Ruth. And when you said something to Aunt Ruth, who's a professor at Hunter, and when you said something to Aunt Ruth and she didn't like it, she'd go like this, while you were talking. So
just want to say, for those who appreciate that this is a radio program, what Aunt Ruth just did is completely lost on your listening audience.
You are good. You're really good. She would move her head back and forth. Quite right. Thank you. That's why you're the governor and I'm just me. So you also say that you promised Diane that you'd make some money. You'd go back into the private sector. I don't want to get into this, but I just wonder whether she's an excuse or whether that, because she's making a lot of money, you know.
Uh-huh.
She's charging $1,000 an hour for her work.
Uh-huh. Well, worth every dime.
Maybe not quite $1,000, maybe $1,500, I don't know. but, you know, we do know that Barack Obama and you are tight, your friends. And we do know you were the co-chair of the campaign. And we do know that you traveled all around with our friend JT and introduced the president and raised money and did all of that. And clearly, unless he's really out of it, you know, he has to take the measure of the man, the strength, the ability, and everything he knows, and say to you, look, I mean, let me put it this way. If he comes to you and says, Deval, we want you to be Attorney General, and I can't do it without you, and I want you to do it, how do you look the President of the United States in the eye and say no?
Well, so, look, the President and I have had that kind of conversation. And more to the point, Diane and I have had that kind of conversation. Number one, I have the only job in politics I've ever wanted. And this is the only job in politics I've ever had. And you know, I mean to finish. For one thing, we haven't had a lot of governors who finished in the last little while, and I have more things I want to accomplish. One thing that is plainer and plainer to me is that 4 or 8 years is really not very long. It's not very long. We don't have term limits here in Massachusetts, but I did promise Diane, and I promised myself that after 2 terms, I would done. And you know, there's a lot of wear and tear in these jobs,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
You get a lot, to be sure, but you give up stuff, too. And some of the things I've given up, we've given up, it'd be nice to have back for a little while. Just a little privacy. Not having the sort of snarky comments about totally insignificant things be a part of the public discourse. It's just, you know, some of it's just tiresome. But I mean, I'm not complaining. I love the job. I have a ball. I get to do things like bear tagging, you know, it's, alongside. And I go, you know, I spend a lot of time in classrooms, and the kids are unbelievable and remarkably present and conscious about what's going on in their communities and in politics to some extent. But you know, one of the beauties for me about not having this as my career is that I can focus on doing the job and not focus on my career. And I do think that that is a difference.
When Roselle tells me something, anything, inevitably I end up doing it. do you tell him stuff?
I do. He doesn't end up doing it.
Well, I know you're passionate. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I know you're passionate about pre-K, for example.
Yeah.
I am. I am, and when I retire, which will be in the next 5 years, I hope, that's where I'm going back. And I'm not going to go back in front of a classroom, but I'm going to go back and focus on early childhood education.
You know Diane was a teacher.
I do indeed, right. And you did it for 5 years, and then you got riffed.
I did. Yeah. Mayor Lindsay.
Yeah.
Remember him?
Oh, indeed. I remember he didn't pick up the snow, and that was the end of him.
Yeah.
So you got riffed. And, I mean, how did that affect you?
Well, I got riffed. It was all I ever wanted to do. My mother, you talked about Aunt Ruth going to Hunter. My mother went to Hunter College.
My mother went to Hunter.
Yeah.
My wife went to Hunter after Skidmore, yeah.
Yeah, and I went to Queens College. I went to the New York City Public Schools all the way through university. And all I wanted to do was to be an early childhood educator. That's what my mother did, and I saw a lot of virtue in that. So when I lost my job, I realized I didn't have a skill, and I thought I better go to a trade school. I went to law school. And I never, ever had any desire, dream, even a notion of what being a lawyer was like. And I've never lost my passion for early childhood education. And so one of the privileges I've had in being First Lady is to spend some time focusing on that issue.
Do you ever, you know, read something in the paper or see something and say, that ain't right?
Every day.
Yeah. And you ever say, Deval, that ain't right?
Every day. Every day I get up and I read the paper. It's like I can't start my day without a couple of cups of coffee and reading the paper. And Deval will not read the paper because he doesn't want to read the good news, because he doesn't want to get a big head about that, and he doesn't want to read the bad news. So I read the paper and I filter it. Yeah. So while he's shaving, I'm saying, you know, Joan Vinaki.
But don't mention names.
Okay.
For those who are listening in another place, that's a columnist for the, right.
for
the Globe, right?
With the Globe. Yeah. I didn't say anything good or bad. I was just mentioning that she writes about you a lot. So I offer my opinions, and Deval, you know, the troopers, you know, you can say something that takes you five sentences to say, and their response is received. I think Deval has picked that up, received. So that's about as far as we get. Received.
You once told me a wonderful story, Diane, about being... Diane and I've talked over the years about at different events and things, and one was she once asked me to tell her about my upbringing, and I said that, you know, I spent my youth in Fire Island. And you talked a little bit about your time on Fire Island.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit?
Well, when I was in high school and college and I needed a summer job, I was a mother's helper on Fire Island. And it was a great gig because I got to spend summers on the beach with children whose mothers didn't want anything to do with them during the day. And got paid marvelously, didn't have to spend any of that money. And in fact, I was a mother's helper for one family who had babies. And, you know, we had the traditional kind of maid's days off. We had, I think, Thursday and every other Saturday off. But even on those days, I was paid extra if I would come back periodically and change the baby's diapers, because the mother did not want to change the baby's diapers. So for me, it was, you know, a lover of children. You know, I was being paid to spend time on a beautiful island and take care of wonderful children, and it was marvelous. I did that for about 4 years.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. The pre-K thing, can we go back there for 1 second and just ask you, based on your observations as a teacher, what is it that happens when you take a kid a year earlier and put him or her in a classroom? It makes such a huge difference, as Deval just said.
It makes an enormous difference. You know, kids are sponges. They just soak in everything. And the latest research will tell you that, and this is where I think, you know, the more progressive educators and agencies are going. You take those kids before they even are born and work with their mothers on, you know, good prenatal care and health. And then the minute they come out of that womb, working with the mothers on good nutrition and health care and the kind of environment to give these kids. And there are wonderful studies that say that first 18 months of life is where you can create, you know, magic or create a problem that's going to last the rest of their lives. And so one of the things that I am trying to do is work with agencies. You know, it's kind of hard to be all in when I've got a full-time practice and First Lady responsibilities, but I'm doing what I can, and that's where I really hope to concentrate. That first 18 months is so amazingly important, and, you know, I'm not a scientist, but, you know, they will show where the, you know, brain cells are developing, and they can either die or they can really thrive and expand. And that's where, you know, we've paid a lot of attention now to preschool and Head Start, but it's really important to even start well before they get there, the minute they breathe their first breath on their own.
I want to stay with you for one more second and ask you about the good that you have done for so many people about depression. You told your story. It awakened in so many of us the idea that we're not alone, you know, when that kind of thing happens.
Well, I'll say, first of all, that it's hard to take credit for that because it wasn't something that I set out to do, to talk about depression. But because I had such a major episode in front of the world, I had to own that. And when I had, again, the strength of this incredible man and my family and great medical help, and once I emerged healthier and stronger, I pinch myself every day how strong I am, I realized how many people could use to know that it's not, because I was told, stop being embarrassed about this. If you have a headache, you take an aspirin. If you break your leg, you go get it fixed. You know, mental illness is about chemical imbalances, at least depression is about chemical imbalances in your brain. And I'm not a scientist, so I can't speak that knowledgeably about it, but fix it. There are ways to fix it. There are, you know, chemical ways to fix it, and there are therapy. And because I was at what I felt was the depths of depression, and because I now feel stronger than I ever have, it's a shame that people won't talk about it, won't get the help, are embarrassed to, and I understand the embarrassment, because you feel like you're a weaker soul somehow. But what I've learned in speaking out about it, I've learned how many people have been helped by not just my speaking out, there are lots of others speaking out about it, but they come to me and they say, I was able to get help. I was able to tell my husband, I was able to tell my job. And particularly in the minority communities, mm-hmm. It's really interesting. We don't talk about this. You don't, you know, get therapy, you know, is often seen as the rich person's, you know, luxury. And you know, we just don't do that. And so I have been around talking to people at like Dimmitt Community Health Center right there in the center of Roxbury, at a women's health day that I now do every year, and talk about depression. And I now see people in the supermarket who say, thank you, you saved my life.
And you know, can I just say that when Diane was there, yes. During the worst of that episode, and it was in the first really bumpy months of my first term, which is what Diane was referring to by having that experience with everybody watching. Diane was in the hospital and they were sneaking me in through the basement and tunnels and stuff like that and at night. And there were her doctors. Diane said, you know, I don't feel well. I'm not ashamed that I don't feel well, but I don't feel well. And I don't want you sneaking in and out. And so we should put out a statement and say, the First Lady's not feeling well, suffering from depression, and so on. And many, many advised against this, including some of her doctors. So the point about strength that I think is important to see in Diane, and I think it's important, Diane, that you see it in yourself, is that that strength was inherently there before she was feeling better. Because it was she who said, no, I want this known. And I think two things that were really wonderful came of that. One was the media on the whole, I would say entirely, were extraordinarily respectful. They didn't follow me around and try to figure out where she was and all that. They were really great in that one fleeting moment. They were really, really great. The other thing was Diane got thousands of cards, letters, notes, emails of encouragement and gratitude, very much on the order of the people who stop her still in the grocery store and so on, saying, your being public about this meant a lot to me and my own wellness.
So let me ask you a question.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd rather talk about her.
If Hillary Clinton came to you and said, I'd like you to run for vice president. I think it would be very smart. Anyway, there must be those what if moments, you know, that you have as a human being.
Sure.
Every once in a while. I have them daily with the lottery.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Yes. I have those too.
What if?
So you know, there in the middle of the night, sometimes, you know, there's that point that you sleep for the first 4 hours. I don't know about you, but I do. I sleep for the first 4 hours. Then you wake up, you have that middle of the night hour, and then you could sometimes go back to sleep. And in that time, you have to amuse yourself. You have to think of something good in your life, like winning the lottery and how you would spend $367 million. What are yours?
Well, I have my lottery fantasies, yes, that is true. And I, you know, I'm a deliberate person, but I you know, people ask you from time to time, what's your 5-year or 10-year plan? And I hate that. Yeah. I hate that question, because what's the line, life is what happens while you're making plans? I mean, I know there's some things about me. I know what I like and what I don't like in terms of the sort of elements of my work life. I know the things I enjoy. I like being the boss. I like it. So I don't see myself running for vice president. I
I'm not, a heartbeat I'm, away from the president.
I got a lot of folks saying, you know, you should run for Senate, and here's your option, and here's your chance, and so on. I respect what senators do, like I respect what a vice president does, but it's not for me. It's not where I think I would make a contribution. And I think I would make a contribution where I think I feel some real passion and where I have a chance to set the agenda, frankly.
Well, like where?
Well, I'd be interested in running a company or a foundation or something, maybe a startup. I like the business of building a team and setting a course and marking progress on the way and encouraging people when there have been setbacks and readjusting and starting off again. I like that, and I'm not bad at it.
Do you still drive a car?
I like ask him driving. If he can parallel park.
Yeah, that's it. I do sometimes drive a car.
Because I remember...
I
remember Mario after he came up to WMC to do his, you know, valedictory address, and I said, where's the governor? And they said, well, he's decided he has to drive his car the first time. And he drove up across the street, and everybody, the police detail, put their hands over their eyes like that. And he went, screech! So you'll have to get some new skills back after this is all over.
He's forgotten how to drive a car, but I have to say he's not forgotten how to put out the garbage on Thursdays. Yeah. It's still very much a...
And he's also a good cook, right?
He's the only one in the house.
And that came from that earlier story you told about where's my dinner.
That's right.
You both love the Berkshires, obviously. Indeed. You're here. We love you.
Thank you.
And we love the fashion.
Thank you.
And we love the fact that you've chosen us and that you spend time with us and that we see you in the West Stockbridge pub, you know, market and around, and that you're not above us, but you're with us. And that is tremendously important to all of us. Are you going to stay with the Berkshires afterwards?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, God willing.
Yeah.
That's why I have to go back into the private sector.
We built the house intending that would be where we would spend our retirement. That's why our bedroom's on the first floor.
And the welcome has been so warm.
People have
been so great. And
they give you your space?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, we're another couple folks walking around in a feed cap most of the time. So we first learned about the Berkshires, I think, the way many out-of-towners do, through the art scene. We have friends who came out here, very dear former law partner of mine and federal judge who's since passed away. Yo-Yo Ma and I went to college together. And
what was that like?
Wild. I mean, he was really good then too. I was active with an outfit called the Phillips Brooks House, which is a volunteer organization, community service organization. And Yo-Yo would do concerts to benefit Phillips Brooks House, and I would help organize the concert. So I got to know him a little bit then. And of course, he and Jill have been coming out here since forever. We remember once Diane and I, when the kids were really small, came out to visit our friends, the Lindsays, and we were driving around afterwards, just enjoying the sights. This one summer. And I pulled up next to a cow pasture, and I said, I want to introduce the kids to these cows. And I got out of the car with our two girls, maybe this big, maybe, I don't know, 4 feet and 2 feet. And I lifted them over the fence and climbed over the fence with them while Diana's in the car screaming, don't do this, don't do this. They're going to stampede. Her view being that all cows behave like those on the old black and white westerns.
They didn't have cows in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
No.
So I didn't know.
Anyway,
right.
So we were walking out. And I'm not sure, but I think it's possible that very cow pasture was in Richmond, based on some familiar scenes where the light goes off when we're driving by. But I'm awfully glad we're here. Really glad we're here.
And as I said before, we're glad you're here. We were out of time, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.